A busy show for a midweek Wednesday, April 20th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. I took some time to point out the ongoing lunacy of how the State General Assembly operates on what now I think is a prehistoric schedule. Author Mike Gonzalez joined us to talk about his new book, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. We also welcomed local gasoline analyst Mike Fox to chat about the current state of gas prices in Connecticut. You know, every so often, I'm reminded that I have to remind you that there's stuff that I'm just right on. And what do I say all the time about the fact that we have these artificial, dumb, stupid deadlines in this state that we need to change? We need to change sometimes how we do things. It doesn't mean you go in there with a sledgehammer or a bulldozer. Maybe instead of using a sledgehammer, you use a scalpel. Maybe instead of using a bulldozer, you use a little push guard. Maybe instead of, using a dynamite, you use a little soft little 4th of July sparkler. You see what I'm saying? There are degrees here. What am I talking about? Well, look at this. Look at this. This headline was sent to me here. State House Speaker Matt Ritter, he said, quote, not quote, but this is the headline here in the Connecticut News Junkie. Time is running short for a budget agreement. Again. I added the again. That's not what the News Junkie headline here is. But come on, folks, seriously. You don't take it from me, whether you love me or hate me, whatever, here on the radio, Monday through Friday, 2 to 6. We hear this every single time the General Assembly tries to put together a budget. Now, they get it done on time, but every budget cycle, kids, right? They sound like petulant children because of these dumb deadlines we have in this state, which leads to lousy lawmaking. It leads to crap coming, you know, the stuff that you can grow some really nice beefsteak tomatoes with. It oftentimes, maybe not always, I can't paint with a broad brush, or I shouldn't. I can do whatever I want. My show. But it often leads to crap coming out of Hartford. The legislature will have a difficult time approving a state budget before the end of its session in 2 weeks if lawmakers and Governor Ned Lamont do not reach an agreement in the next 48 hours. That's according to House Speaker Matt Ritter. So again, here we are with these short deadlines. Oh, we've got to get it done by the end of the, by the end of 2 weeks, at the end of April. So again, you know, we have the short session in the General Assembly, the long session. This is why, and I know it would probably be a constitutional nightmare to do this. It would, you know, it's like landing men on the moon again. But why don't we change things to make this better? This notion that we have one longer legislative session, 1 year in the odd years, so they're not facing an election and they can really stick it to you with taxes. And then in the even years, they do the warm, fuzzy stuff. This is just ridiculous. It's embarrassing. During a morning press briefing, Matt Ritter said, and I'm not blaming the Speaker Ritter. Listen, he's got to run the House. He's got to, that's his, just like Nancy Pelosi in Washington, maybe Kevin McCarthy again if he becomes a House Speaker, who knows. During a morning press briefing, Matt Ritter said the legislative schedule was looking increasingly crowded in the time remaining before the conclusion of the session at midnight on May 5th. Well, why is it concluding on May 5th? Why? Why do we still, in the year 2022, with all the stuff we have to take care of, we have these dumb, idiotic, asinine limits? Well, Paul, those limits, are in the Constitution. All right, fix them. And I know what I know there are some people that would call me and may very well do that before the end of the show, saying, well, the lesser that lawmakers are in Hartford, the better. Ah, stop. come on, that's nice pie-in-the-sky stuff. But in the real world of lawmaking, no, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way when you have short sessions with everything compacted, with budgetary stuff and social spending stuff. You end up invariably, more times than not, getting crap legislation and crap budgets. Instead of taking time, taking 6 or 7 or 8 months and saying, hey, let's do this in an educated way. Let's make sure all sides are heard. Let's let people have plenty of debate about it. But no, we do these dumb, idiotic, asinine, compressed schedules. And you have lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who are going to say, well, we have great ideas, but we're running short on time. Why are we running short on time? What sense does that make in the year 2022? Can you explain that to me? I'd love to put you on the radio. If you can tell me at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, how does any of this make sense? House leaders expected a debate over raises for state employees to take several hours on Thursday, and lawmakers will need to dedicate a time early next week to approving new judges. But the legislature's most important task in a short session is making adjustments to the 2-year state budget. And as of Wednesday, lawmakers and the administration have yet to agree on spending. And they say, oh, no, we have to do this in 2 weeks. Well, they're going to rush it at the end. And they may do a lot of this on an overnight session, kids, when you and I, you know what we're doing at that time? And that's when all this budget stuff gets done in Hartford, right? How often do we hear of, you know, you wake up the morning after the session, our top story this morning, lawmakers were up until 4 a.m. in the morning debating and voting on a state budget. How is that allowed? Why is that allowed? Well, Paul, that's the legislative process. No, it's not. No, it's not. In the year 2022, it is garbage. And yet year in and year out, the good people of this state, the good people of the state of Connecticut, are subjected to garbage lawmaking when we should take our time. We should take a breath. We should allow the maximum amount of debate for the maximum amount of people to watch. But we got to do this, we got to do that. We don't have any time. I'm telling you, like petulant children rushing that book report that they knew was due a month ago. Traffic and weather together right here, WICC. I had a vent before, I feel better. But it's just maddening, folks, isn't it to you? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Matt Ritter, the state House Speaker, the number 3 person in the government in Connecticut, next to Governor Ned Lamont, Lieutenant Governor Susan Bicewicz, and then the House Speaker, traditionally in the way government is set up, is the number 3 person in the government, talking about here's when he was asked about the timetable to do a budget, which should be the first thing they do, right? Shouldn't the budget be the first thing they do? But instead, we do vaping stuff, and we do right-to-die stuff, and we're doing abortion stuff now, and all these other bills that are just social, you know, policy bills, which is fine. I understand that's part of the rule of a legislature. Whether it's a Democrat or Republican legislature, I get that. But do the damn budget first. What are you all wrapped up about this? I'll tell you why. Because at the end, if they squeeze it in, either in a special session or overnight while you and I are sleeping, so we don't know what's going on, there's going to be crap in it. There's going to be garbage in it, and there's going to be crap in it. Matt Ritter saying he hoped negotiations would allow the legislature to approve a budget soon because looming political campaigns and the statewide nominating conventions of both parties will make scheduling a special session to approve a budget difficult. They can't do it. They can't approve a budget because that means we would have to schedule a special session. And it's an election year. What comes first? Mind-numbing, kids. It is mind-numbing. Matt Ritter saying, quote, the clock is not on our side and the parade of this is a great line he said here. Listen to this. And you get the impression that Matt Ritter here is the House Speaker, the Democratic House Speaker, saying, like, come on, let's get our stuff together. He said, quote, the clock is not on our side and the parade of horribles of what a special session could bring, I don't even want to imagine what that could look like. Folks, this is what I'm telling you. This is why it's 2022 and we still do stuff here in this state, especially for the men and women you elect. And a lot of you elect the same people every 2 years because you have no idea of what's going on in Hartford and you have little impetus to even know. What time's the Yankee game on tonight? Well, don't you want to know how your laws are being made? Nope. Don't care. Don't know. Don't care. This is why it's 2022. And we conduct our business at the Capitol like it's 1722 or 1822. Oh, my God. They don't even leave themselves enough time. They make lousy laws and pass lousy budgets that have crap and garbage in them. And rats, what they call rats, little hidden laws in the bill that kicks all this in. You know, while you and I are sleeping, it's mind numbing. It's mind numbing. And Ritter's talking here about, you know, what the time constraint does. He said, quote, the question gets asked at some point, well, why do it this year if you don't have to? But the counter to that is it's a marker. It's important and making sure we're funding priorities. Okay, I get that, Mr. Speaker. So do the budget first. Don't allow any other bill. See, here's what I would do. I would say I'd treat them like kids. You're not getting your dessert. The social bills you like, the abortion bills, vaping bills, stuff like that. I'd say that's like dessert. I'd say you're not getting any of that. No, 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 no. You're not getting any of that till you eat your meat and potatoes, and that's the budget. Do that first. This, folks, I'm telling you, this is just maddening to me. That's why I say, I'm telling you, two things. Lengthen out the legislative session, and for the love of sweet God, pay lawmakers more. I'm telling you. What do you want to do that for, Paul? Because, again, if there was a higher pay, you could actually get a wider variety of people in Hartford. Not targeting anybody individually, but remember, when you pay so little for your legislature, there's only a certain cadre of worker or individual who can afford to do the job. And I don't know about you, there are not a lot of blue-collar people, working-class people who could be in Hartford who can do that for $28,000 a year, please. And don't call me, and please, if you're going to call me, do not bring up the, well, they shouldn't do it for the money. Stop that. Stop that. It's not 1930 anymore. It's not Mr. Smith goes to Washington anymore. Let's deal in here and now. Our next guest is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy. Previous to that, he spent close to 20 years as a reporter, a journalist, 15 of them writing from Europe, Asia, and Latin America. Worked for the Bush White House as a speechwriter. Then he moved on to the State Department, the European Bureau there, and now has written a new book called BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution, and Mike Gonzalez joins us. Hey, Mike, it's Paul here on WICC in Connecticut. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, Paul, how are you? I was just in Norwalk 2 weeks ago speaking to a group there.
Wow. Excellent. All right, good. So you know the territory here, Mike. I got you. All right, that's cool. Mike, listen, I think part of the promotional material here is a good summary of what your book's trying to do here. You tell me. No person of goodwill could object to the proposition that Black lives matter as much as any other human life, but Americans need to understand how their laudable moral concern is being exploited for purposes that a great many of them would not approve. That's some heavy stuff, Mike, but I guess that's why you wrote the book. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, no, actually, I affirm the Black Lives Matter. I don't even say all lives matter. I'm just saying, Paul, they all do. All 7 billion of us on Earth are children of God. You know, I hold a special place in my heart for 330 million fellow Americans. But it's important to affirm that Black Lives Matter. But when we talk about Black Lives Matter, it's not the concept that we should talk about, nor the movement, because the movement, I don't know, it's vague, people who marched. It's the organizations and their founders. The founders of the organizations were Marxists, are Marxists. In fact, I would call them fanatical Marxists, who were trained by Marxist theoreticians who knew what they were doing. And they were trained into the art of cultural Marxism, which is, how do you infiltrate society? How do you take over the cultural institutions? And how do you indoctrinate Americans into believing that we live in an oppressive society, that America is a hateful place, that we're systemically racist, that there's white privilege, and so forth? And that is what they have been doing. Well before they created Black Lives Matter in 2013, they were already deeply enmeshed into a network, a huge, vast network of socialist institutions and organizations across the country. And then the acquittal of George Zimmerman of the murder of Trayvon Martin in 2013, and definitely Michael Brown's death in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, gave him the social justice excuse to put into place this blueprint.
All right, Mike, hang on. Good stuff there for a start. We'll be right back to you. The guest is Mike Gonzalez from the Heritage Foundation, name of the book BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. Who are the people that are running this organization? And Mike is careful to make the distinction between the organization BLM and the ideas that seem so laudable and have brought in, you know, tens of millions of dollars. But who exactly are these people? More with Mike coming up first. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. 600 AM, 107.3 FM and online at WICC600.com. Mike Gonzalez is the guest. The name of the book, BLM, The Making of a Marxist Revolution. Mike, you set us up good there in that first segment, so let's get a little deeper into this. The people that are actually the drivers behind the actual organization, who are some of these people? For example, you see and hear a lot from Patrice Cullors. Who is she? What is she about? How did she attain this position?
Well, there's really four. People talk about three. Patrice Cullors is definitely the most prominent, or one of the most prominent. Also, a claim to that title is Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi. And then the one least mentioned, but also very, very important, is Melina Abdullah, the head of the L.A. chapter of BLM. And now you ask about Patrice Cullors, and she's a case in point of what I was saying, Paul. She was trained well before Trayvon Martin in 2013 and Black Lives Matter. She was trained by the Labor Community Strategy Center, which was founded in Los Angeles by Eric Mann. Who's Eric Mann? Well, he's a former member of the Weather Underground. For those in your audience who don't remember who that is, what that is, the Weather Underground was a terrorist organization designated terrorist by the FBI. Eric Mann himself served time in prison. When he got out in the 80s, he founded the Labor Community Strategy Center to train people on how to overthrow the United States. He says that America is the most oppressive country in the world. He, in his book, he claims, he states in his book in 2012 that his center picked Cullors, recruited is the word he used, Cullors, at the tender age of 17, and then that they trained her for 10 years. They trained her for 10 years from the age of 17 on how to organize, how to understand Marxist ideology, how to understand Leninism, how to understand Maoism, and how to how to organize people at bus stops or in buses. That's where she trained, in order to instill in them a hatred of the United States, an idea that they were oppressed, that this is an oppressive society. That is Patrice Couleur's by herself. There's a story behind all the other three.
Now, I see over the past couple, 3 weeks, maybe a month or so, Mike, I'm starting to see more and more stories about not just BLM's detractors from a political point of view and people like you who know the background here, but even now organizations who gave them money, you know, the federal government, the IRS saying, hey, what are you doing with all this money we gave you, and do you have a structure for this? How is this being run as a charitable organization? So they're starting to feel some heat here, correct, Mike?
Yeah, no, and I'm glad that the grift is finally getting attention. But to me, the grift is not the most important aspect, right? I mean, you know, we'll always have grifters with us. And that a communist buys a mansion, it's really people who say, well, that's ironic. No, it's not. You know, Chernenko and Brezhnev and Andropov, they all had their luxury dachas in the countryside, in the Russian countryside. Mm-hmm. Fidel Castro died a billionaire. This is nothing out of the ordinary. No, what's out of the ordinary is that Marxists have been able to transform American society to the degree that they have. We have been changed, Paul, and we're in the process of being changed. Now, the American people have stood up and said, no, we're going to reverse a lot of this. We're going to reverse all of it. And there's a big fight. It's a cultural fight. It's a cultural war. Why is it a cultural war? Because we're facing cultural Marxists. Marxists that no longer believe in believe they agree with what Marx tried to do, abolishing the family, the nation state, private property, etc. They just don't think it can be achieved through a violent revolution. It has to be achieved through cultural work, by infiltrating society, by having a long march through the institutions, etc. That's what we're being faced with right now.
And so race, Mike Gonzalez, I guess, is kind of their tool here they use to inoculate themselves. Well, if you oppose us, Mike, you must be racist. I can imagine what people have said about your book here. Have you been dubbed a white supremacist, Mike, a racist for writing this yet?
You know, if I have, it really doesn't bother me. The only color that matters here is red, the color of communism. Eric Mann himself, in 2015, gave a very candid interview. He said, you know, we Marxists, we communists, whether we're working on climate, whether we're working on sex, whether we're working on gender, whether we're working on race, this is just a little quote-unquote division of labor that we have. What we're really trying to do is overthrow the United States. So race has nothing to do with it. It's just a veneer.
Does the federal government, Mike, and the powers that be, would you bet, as I would, that they know this, they know who these people are, there are files on these people, Mike, but maybe there is also a tacit fear of, geez, we can't push back against these people because we'll take too much flack. I mean, the powers that be, Mike, on the federal level, judicial, IRS, they know what's going on here. They have to.
Well, Paul, do I have a tale for you? One of the chapters of my book, I look into how the FBI, after Ferguson, actually had a tool for this. It was called Black Identity Extremism, and they used that to monitor the activities of Black identity extremists. Like, for example, James, the guy, you know, the guy that is the Brooklyn subway shooter.
Yeah.
The FBI came under incredible pressure from the Congressional Black Caucus, from the Brennan Center, from leftist publications, and the FBI dissolved this category. Christopher Wray, under investigation at a congressional hearing from Cory Booker, said to Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, we do no longer use a Black identity extremism. Whether the Brooklyn subway shooter could have been nabbed, or the guy who plowed into a Christmas crowd in Waukesha, last Christmas, you know, we would have had a lot better data had the FBI not been pressurized into stopping this.
So in the future, how do you think, Mike Gonzalez, this shakes out? What has happened? Now, I would imagine that has a lot to do with what happens in November with the midterms and in 2024. You know, you said America was pushing back on this with all good intention of still making sure that there's no racial bias in law enforcement and all that, get rid of the bad cops. But politically, Mike, how do you think this shakes out over the next 1, 2, maybe 3 years?
Well, it depends. It depends on what the Republicans and Democrats do, right? I mean, look, Milton Friedman put it very well, said if you have the right climate of opinion, even the bad politicians will end up doing the right thing. If the climate of opinion is no good, then forget about electing good politicians, because the good politicians will not do the right thing. But what we have to remember is Richard Nixon, who was not good, by the way, when he said we're all Keynesians now, he was a Republican. He was saying that we're all believing big government now. And then Bill Clinton in the 1990s, 20 years later, said the era of big government is over, and he signed the welfare bill. What had changed? What had changed was the climate of opinion. So I am not going to put my hope in politicians. I want to do what I'm doing right now with you, which is exposing this, trying to change the climate of opinion, so then when politicians come in, they will do the right thing. One right thing would be to investigate the 2020 riots, I must say.
The name of the book is BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. Mike Gonzalez is the guest and the author. Mike, thank you. Good luck with the book, and hopefully we can chat down the road. Thanks, Mike.
Anytime, Paul. Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. Bye. Thank you. All right. Mike was in Fairfield County the other night. How about that? BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. The point of the book is, as history has borne out, folks, you know, communists used to try and infiltrate, you know, left-leaning, progressive, civil rights organizations that had a good and wholesome outlook on what they wanted to accomplish in American society. But, you know, the outside left, those of other countries have said, hey, if we can sow some racial discontent or discontent of the poor, we can fracture America. And it's happening with BLM, right? Well, have we dodged the rhetorical bullet here when it comes to, you know, uber high gas prices, or will they get even higher when the driving season kicks in? Our buddy, our pal, to talk about that and more, Mike Fox joins us from GASDA, the Gasoline and Auto Service Dealers of America, located in Fairfield County. Mike, it's Paul here again, sir. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. Thank you for having me.
Well, great to have you back, Mike. I'm looking at some of the gas price maps here. I'm seeing, of course, after that tax cut we had for the last quarter here, that 25-cent a gallon tax cut, generally, you know, upper $3. There are some $4 plus prices in the area. Give us the outlook right now. What are you seeing? What are you hearing?
I think you're going to see us get right back to that high price that we saw, and here's the reason why. The wholesale market, New Haven Harbor, where we all get our gas deliveries from, has just been a roller coaster. Last week, we had the first 5-day week where we saw wholesale prices drop every single day, may have only been a couple cents here, a couple cents there. And now the market has completely turned around, and we're back to seeing yesterday we saw 20 cent increases in the wholesale price, which pretty much ate up all those decreases that we saw last week. Today it's down about 2, but again, we're on that roller coaster ride where I've always said in the past, and it continues to be the fact, it rises like a rocket and it drops like a feather. But I do not see anything in the future right now that changes anything but higher gas prices for the summer. And I'm actually saying, even with the 25 cent reduction or the suspension in the gas tax, is a better way of putting it, we may hit $5 a gallon.
When do we start to see the effect of, Mike Fox, the summer blends? Has that changeover begun already? When does that usually happen? When are we going to see it?
Yeah, it starts now. so that all of the tanks that are in New Haven are actually full with the summer blend of gasoline, so that what goes in the truck is a full blend of summer gasoline, and then what goes in our tanks is a mixture of the old blend and the new blend, because no one can ever really get to zero to say, okay, we're all out of the winter blend, now drop in the summer blend. I think fundamentally that's some of the problem that the state legislature just doesn't understand. It's not like you buy a gallon of milk and you run out and you get the next gallon. It just doesn't work like that in the gas business.
All right, Mike, hang on. We'll be right back with you. More with our buddy Mike Fox from Gazda. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And it's not quite the summer driving season yet, but we're getting there, and we have the summer blends now in the wholesale tanks. That's what our buddy, our pal, our guest Mike Fox says from Gazda, the Gasoline and Auto Service Dealers Association of America, located in Fairfield County. Mike, have we felt the effects yet of the U.S. allegedly having a desire to pull away from Russian crude oil, or is that still down the road to be felt here when it gets to the pump? Yes or no?
Yes, we have felt those effects because that's a global market. So the issue really is do we bring Russian crude here to the U.S.? The people who buy the Russian crude are more the Europeans. But when you're buying crude oil on the global market, which we are now because we are no longer a net exporter of crude oil like we were under the prior administration, then we have to buy in that global market. And that global market's price went up to, I think it's $114 or $115 a barrel today. So, yes, technically when the president says it's a Putin price increase, it's an increase because of the global market. But where we are and why we are in Connecticut is because of the current administration's policies on fossil fuels. Now, we're seeing slowly but surely the president is starting to roll back some of those policies. Let me give you like a really quick, easy example.
Sure.
When they cut off the Keystone pipeline, you cut off the ability to put in an order at a refinery for, say, 50,000 barrels of crude oil, and you want to buy it from Canada. And you put the order in at 8 o'clock, and it arrives at the refinery at 8:01. Well, now you put in an order for 50,000 barrels of crude oil. It has to come by a ship. It has to come from a foreign country that may or may not be friendly to us. So simply the delay in transportation and the increased cost in transportation is why it's costing us more money. And that's what it means to be energy independent here in the U.S. rather than dependent. No matter what happens in the world market, if we were energy independent, we wouldn't be facing these huge price increases.
And you mentioned, Mike, a couple of seconds ago that I guess I did read that there's a movement, slight movement now from the administration on, what did I read, leases for federal land and changes gradually to try and open up more of that land. How's that working?
And again, it's a spin on words because not a lot of people are really familiar with the process. Yes, the Biden administration is opening up a certain percentage of leases. 80% of those leases are still not open like they were before. And the issue is the lease is one part of the process. Still need a permit. The Keystone pipeline, you need the money to build the pipeline, but then you need the permit. President Trump issued the permit to build the Keystone pipeline, and President Biden revoked the permit. So how is an energy company going to invest $2, $3, $4, $5 billion with the whim that, well, maybe tomorrow the permit gets yanked? And they didn't do anything wrong. There was no environmental problem. Nothing changed. And that is the problem that, and I'm not a defender of the major oil companies, that's for sure. But look, we had the major oil companies during the pandemic lose $20 billion. And then I saw in the hearings the other day, they were criticizing one company because they made $21 billion. Well, if you take a loss of 20 and you make 21, put the two together, they made $1 billion in 2 years.
Yeah.
For a big, huge company, that's not a lot of money. Shareholders would consider that a bad year.
Oh, absolutely. And Mike, I don't know how to phrase this question. If in the near future, Mike, let's say 6, 8, 9, 10 months, a year out, what do you think realistically could be the lowest that you and I in this area could pay for a gallon of gas again here in Connecticut at our local station in the relative near future. Could that drop any or not?
Well, listen, you're asking the billion-dollar question. If someone was able to answer that question accurately to within a dime, they could become a billionaire overnight. The problem is, what is the policy finally going to be as we get closer and closer to elections in November? What's going to happen if it's a huge Republican sweep in November? Are the Democrats then just going to flip-flop and undo all the damage that they've done? And the problem is the inconsistencies. Big business plans 5 years out, not for 5 minutes. And these policies seem to be something that, you know, look at the mask. But we're going to extend it for 2 more weeks. And now the courts come in and they say, nope, that mask mandate was illegal. And we've waiting 4 days before we can get an answer on whether the administration is even going to appeal it. Well, imagine those airlines that for the last 4 days, you could take your mask off and then maybe tomorrow you got to put your mask back on. It's those type of inconsistencies that cause a business to go crazy and their customers to go crazy. And we're seeing that. And listen, we're seeing it in our gas stations every day. Here's our big fear. We have this suspension of the gas tax getting ready to expire on June 30th, and that's not that far away. And July 1st is going to be your holiday weekend, one of the highest travel weekends that we always have in Connecticut. And I can guarantee you the price of gas is going to go up 25 cents on July 1st because the gas tax comes back in. What I can't tell you is if the market goes up 20 cents on Friday and Saturday as well, the price will go up 45 or 50 cents. Tack on 50 cents to today's price. You said earlier there's some stations at $4 a gallon. That means Friday, July 1st, they would be $4.50. And they're not gouging. They're not making a penny more. In fact, it costs them more.
Got it. Mike Fox.
That is the problem that we face.
Mike Fox from Gazda. Mike, always good to hear from you. We'll check in as we get closer to that July weekend. Mike, thank you. Take care. We'll be in touch. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. All right. Mike Fox there from Gazda. There you go. So it's all fluid. You hear what he said there? And again, this isn't necessarily a partisan thing, but the more he tells me this, the more I read into it. You know, he's essentially right. You know, the big oil companies, the conglomerates, they see who's controlling Congress, right? And a lot of them say, oh, Democrats come in, they're going to regulate us more, they're going to put limits on oil, limits on drilling, okay, we better make our money now. You know, and they may say after Election Day, who knows what's going to happen. Again, I don't know if there's going to be this red tsunami that everybody is talking about. But if there is, you know, like Mike said, are they suddenly going to say, oh, that's better. Okay, we can lower our prices a little bit, lower the wholesale prices, you know, crank up the production out of the refineries. Remember, gasoline, crude oil, it's a commodity. We may not think of it that way, but it is.